Chapter 33. All who could do so gazed from the little back window of the van, but the curate was not in sight. Now I wonder where that there man is? Apostrophe apostrophe continued the carrier. Poor man, he ought to have a living at his time of life. Apostrophe apostrophe, and he ought to be punctual, apostrophe said the carrier. 4 o'clock sharp is my time for starting, I said to N. And he said, I'll be there. Now he's not here, and as a serious old church minister he ought to be as good as his word. Perhaps Mr. Flexton knows, being in the same line of life? Apostrophe apostrophe he turned to the parish clerk. I was talking an immense deal with him, that's true, half an hour ago, apostrophe replied that ecclesiastic, as one of whom it was no erroneous supposition that he should be on intimate terms with another of the cloth. But he didn't say he would be late. Apostrophe, the discussion was cut off by the appearance round the corner of the van of rays from the curate's spectacles, followed hastily by his face and a few white whiskers, and the swinging tails of his long gaunt coat. Nobody reproached him, seeing how he was reproaching himself, and he entered breathlessly, and took his seat. Now be we all here? Apostrophe apostrophe said the carrier again. They started a second time, and moved on till they were about 300 yards out of the town, and had nearly reached the second bridge, behind which, as every native remembers, the road takes a turn and travelers by this highway disappear finally from the view of gazing burghers. Well, as I'm alive, apostrophe apostrophe cried the postmistress from the interior of the conveyance, peering through the little square back window along the road townward. What? Apostrophe apostrophe said the carrier. A man hailing us. Apostrophe apostrophe, another sudden stoppage. Somebody else? Apostrophe the carrier asked. Eh, sure. Apostrophe apostrophe all waited silently, while those who could gaze out did so. Now, who can that be? Apostrophe apostrophe Burthen continued. I just put it to ye, neighbors, can any man keep time with such hindrances? Bain't we full arity? Who in the world can the man be? Apostrophe, he's a sort of gentleman, apostrophe said the schoolmaster, his position commanding the road more comfortably than that of his comrades. The stranger, who had been holding up his umbrella to attract their notice, was walking forward leisurely enough, now that he found, by their stopping, that it had been secured. His clothes were decidedly not of a local cut, though it was difficult to point out any particular mark of difference. In his left hand he carried a small leather traveling bag. As soon as he had overtaken the van he glanced at the inscription on its side, as if to assure himself that he had hailed the right conveyance, and asked if they had room. The carrier replied that, though they were pretty well laden he supposed they could carry one more, whereupon the stranger mounted, and took the seat cleared for him within. And then the horses made another move, this time for good, and swung along with their burden of 14 souls all told. You bain't one of these parts, sir? Apostrophe apostrophe said the carrier. I could tell that as far as I could see ye. Apostrophe apostrophe, yes, I am one of these parts, apostrophe said the stranger. Oh? H apostrophe M. Apostrophe, the silence which followed seemed to imply a doubt of the truth of the newcomer's assertion. I was speaking of Upper Longpuddle more particular, apostrophe continued the carrier heartily, and I think I know most faces of that valley. Apostrophe apostrophe, I was born at Longpuddle, and nursed at Longpuddle, and my father and grandfather before me, apostrophe said the passenger quietly. Why, to be sure, apostrophe said the aged groceress in the background, it isn't John Lackland's son never it can't be he who went to foreign parts 35 years ago with his wife and family. Yet what do I hear? That's his father's voice. Apostrophe, that's the man, apostrophe replied the stranger. John Lackland was my father, and I am John Lackland's son. 35 years ago, when I was a boy of 11, My parents emigrated across the seas, taking me and my sister with them. Kite's boy Tony was the one who drove us and our belongings to Castor Bridge on the morning we left, and his was the last long puddle face I saw. We sailed the same week across the ocean, and there we've been ever since, and there I've left those I went with all three. ... alive or dead. ... dead. ... he replied in a low voice. And I have come back to the old place, having nourished a thought, not a definite intention, but just a thought, that I should like to return here in a year or two, to spend the remainder of my days. ... married man, Mr. Lackland? ... no. ... and have the world used ye well, sir, or rather John, knowing ye as a child. In these rich new countries, that we hear of so much, you've got rich with the rest? ... I am not very rich, ... Mr. Lackland said. Even in new countries, you know, there are failures. The race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, and even if it sometimes is, you may be neither swift nor strong. However, that's enough about me. Now, having answered your inquiries, you must answer mine, for being in London, I have come down here entirely to discover what Long Puddle is looking like, and who are living there. That was why I preferred a seat in your van to hiring a carriage for driving across. ... well, as for Long Puddle, we rub on there much as usual. Old figures have dropped out o' their frames, so to speak it, and new ones have been put in their places. You mentioned Tony Kites as having been the one to drive your family and your goods to Castor Bridge in his father's wagon when you left. Tony is, I believe, living still, but not at Long Puddle. He went away and settled at Lewgate, near Mellstock, after his marriage. Ah, Tony was a sort of man. ... His character had hardly come out when I knew him. ... no. But 'twas well enough, as far as that goes, except as to women. I shall never forget his courting, never. ... The returned villager waited silently, and the carrier went on. Tony Kites, the arch deceiver, I shall never forget Tony's face. 'Twas a little, round, firm, tight face, with a seam here and there left by the smallpox, but not enough to hurt his looks in a woman's eye, though he'd had it baitish when he was a boy. So very serious looking and unsmiling was that young man, that it really seemed as if he couldn't laugh at all without great pain to his conscience. He looked very hard at a small speck in your eye when talking to ye. And there was no more sign of a whisker or beard on Tony Kite's face than on the palm of my hand. He used to sing "He Tailors Breeches" with a religious manner, as if it were a hymn. Oh, the petticoats went off, and the breeches they went on. And all the rest of the scandalous stuff. He was quite the women's favorite, and in return for their likings he loved them in shoals. But in course of time Tony got fixed down to one in particular, Millie Richards, a nice, light, small, tender little thing, and it was soon said that they were engaged to be married. One Saturday he had been to market to do business for his father, and was driving home the wagon in the afternoon. When he reached the foot of the very hill we shall be going over in 10 minutes, who should he see waiting for him at the top but Unity Sallet, a handsome girl, one of the young women he'd been very tender toward before he'd got engaged to Millie. As soon as Tony came up to her she said, "My dear Tony, will you give me a lift home?" "That I will, darling," said Tony. "Oo don't suppose I could refuse ye?" She smiled a smile, and up she hopped, and on drove Tony. "Tony," she says, in a sort of tender chide, "why did he desert me for that other one? And what is she better than I? I should have made ye a finer wife, and a more loving one too. 'Tisn't girls that are so easily won at first, that are the best. Think how long we've known each other ever, since we were children almost now, haven't we, Tony?" "Yes, that we have," says Tony, a-struck with the true thought. "And you've never seen anything in me to complain of, have ye, Tony?" Now tell the truth to me. I never have, upon my life, says Tony. And can you say I'm not pretty, Tony? Now look at me. He let his eyes light upon her for a long while. Really can't, says he. In fact, I never knowed you was so pretty before. Prettier than she? What Tony would have said to that nobody knows, for before he could speak, what should he see ahead, over the hedge past the turning, but a feather he knew well the feather in Millie's hat she to whom he had been thinking of putting the question, as to giving out the banns that very week. Unity, says he, as mild as he could, here's Millie coming. Now I shall catch it mightily, if she sees ye riding here with me, and if you get down she'll be turning the corner in a moment, and, seeing ye in the road, she'll know we've been coming on together. Now, dearest Unity, will ye, to avoid all unpleasantness, which I know ye can't bear any more than I, will ye lie down in the back part of the wagon, and let me cover you over with the tarpaulin till Millie has passed? It will all be done in a minute. Do. And I'll think over what we've said. And perhaps I shall put a loving question to you after all, instead of to Millie. Tisn't true that it is all settled between her and me. Well, Unity Salad agreed, and lay down at the back end of the wagon, and Tony covered her over, so that the wagon seemed to be empty, but for the loose tarpaulin. And then he drove on to meet Millie. My dear Tony, cries Millie, looking up with a little pout at him as he came near. How long you've been coming home? Just as if I didn't live at Upper Longpuddle at all. And I've come to meet you as you asked me to do, and to ride back with you, and talk over our future home since you asked me, and I promised. But I shouldn't have come else, Mr. Tony. Eh, my dear, I did ask ye to be sure I did, now I think of it, but I had quite forgot it. To ride back with me, did you say, dear Millie? Well, of course. What can I do else? Surely you don't want me to walk, now I've come all this way? Oh no, no. I was thinking you might be going on to town to meet your mother. I saw her there, and she looked as if she might be expecting ye. Oh no, she's just home. She came across the fields, and so got back before you. Ah, I didn't know that, says Tony. And there was no help for it, but to take her up beside him. They talked on very pleasantly, and looked at the trees, and beasts, and birds, and insects, and at the plowmen at work in the fields, till presently who should they see looking out of the upper window of a house, that stood beside the road they were following, but Hannah Jolliver, another young beauty of the place at that time, and the very first woman, that Tony had fallen in love with before Millie and before Unity, in fact the one, that he had almost arranged to marry instead of Millie. She was a much more dashing girl than Millie Richards, though he'd not thought much of her of late. The house Hannah was looking from was her aunt's. My dear Millie, my coming wife, as I may call ye, says Tony in his modest way, and not so loud, that Unity could overhear, I see a young woman looking out of window, who I think may accost me. The fact is, Millie, as he had a notion, that I was wishing to marry her, and since she's discovered I've promised another, and a prettier than she, I'm rather afeard of her temper, if she sees us together. Now, Millie, would you do me a favor, my coming wife, as I may say? Certainly, dearest Tony, says she. Then would ye creep under the empty sacks just here in the front of the wagon, and hide there out of sight till we've passed the house? As he hasn't seen us yet. You see, we ought to live in peace, and goodwill since 'tis almost Christmas, and 'twill prevent angry passions rising, which we always should do. I don't mind. To oblige you, Tony, Millie said. And though she didn't care much about doing it, she crept under, and crouched down just behind the seat, Unity being snug at the other end. So they drove until they got near the roadside cottage. Hannah had soon seen him coming, and waited at the window, looking down upon him. She tossed her head a little disdainful and smiled offhand. Well, aren't you going to be civil enough to ask me to ride home with you, she says, seeing that he was for driving past with a nod and a smile. Ah, to be sure. What was I thinking of? said Tony, in a flutter. But you seem as if you were staying at your aunt's. No, I am not, she said. Aunt, you see I have my bonnet and jacket on? I have only called to see her on my way home. How can you be so stupid, Tony? In that case, of course you must come along. Why me, says Tony, feeling a dim sort of sweat rising up inside his clothes. And he reined in the horse, and waited till she'd come downstairs, and then helped her up beside him. He drove on again, his face as long as a face, that was a round one by nature well could be. Hannah looked round sideways into his eyes. His is nice, isn't it, Tony, she says. Like riding with you. Tony looked back into her eyes. And I with you, he said after a while. In short, having considered her, he warmed up, and the more he looked at her the more he liked her, till he couldn't for the life of him think why he had ever said a word about marriage to Millie, or Unity while Hannah Jolliver was in question. So they sat a little closer and closer, their feet upon the footboard and their shoulders. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.